You know, The Wire is a great example. You know, it was a show that kind of existed outside of Hollywood's traditional structure. It's one reason why they didn't get that many Emmy nominations when the show was on, because they were making the show in Baltimore. They were using these actors that were English or actors that were like Michael Kay, who you know, weren't really on anybody's radar screen. David Simon and the folks who worked on the show, I think of the writers particularly, you know, kind of enjoyed their outsider status, you know, which I think also kind of pissed off Hollywood a little bit. So it was nice that The Wire could feature these people who would normally never get much of a shot in traditional Hollywood.
Hey everybody, I'm Kobe.
And I'm Dave.
And welcome to The Wire Strip. We're the podcast that goes through each episode of The Wire, one by one. And you don't just hear from us, you hear from some of the cast, some of the crew, and some of you guys too.
Yes, this week we are doing episode 8 of season 4. It's called Corner Boys. And if you want to chat to us about anything you hear on this episode or anything you think we've missed or whatever, you can do it at The Wire Strip on Twitter, Instagram, or email us, burner@thewirestripped.com.
Without any further ado, let's get to the chat that we recorded earlier. Season 4, Episode 8, Corner Boys.
When you walk through the garden, you gotta watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon, walk the straight and narrow track. When you walk with Jesus, he's gonna save your soul. Just gotta keep the devil way down in the hole. He got the fire and the fury at his command.
Hey guys, welcome to the Wire Strip Podcast. Myself and Dave are here at Marlowe's Playground. Is it a playground?
Is it a playground? Yeah, it's kind of like, if it's a playground, it's some seriously unused and
yeah.
Rotting playground. Yeah, but there's kind of, it's a bit like a skate park vibe.
Yeah.
Skate park playground, maybe unused.
Flat concrete.
Yeah. Well, I love it. It's almost like a court.
Mm.
It's a courtyard in a way, but it's almost like a court, the way he holds court there. You know, he's got his three chairs.
Sure.
You know, and people come and sit down next to him, and it's like, come,
yeah.
You know, it's like his own little,
and it dispels his advice, and then
yeah,
they go.
It's true, yeah. It is. It's there's something Arthurian about it, but I kind of like how humble it all is. You know, it's like
it's definitely.
Not like Stringer Bell up in a penthouse and Barksdale in the, you know, in the back of the strip
funeral.
Club, you know, the
yes,
glamorous strip
true.
Club or the funeral home.
The glamorous strip club.
You know, he's a very, but there's probably a tactical element to it as well, where he's in the open air. Maybe mm-hmm. it's he can see everyone coming from a mile off.
That's true.
You also feel like he could be picked off from a window, though.
He could be picked off from, but I think, I mean, this is again part of Herc's stupidity. I don't know, stupidity is maybe harsh, but. Herc's ineptitude.
Stupidity is not harsh.
Herc's ineptitude here is that Marlowe's picked that for a reason. He's got people on every possible entrance, and they probably yeah. see people going in and out of. They probably know who's in any building at any one time. So he's got the whole area cordoned off. So to be coming in there, rolling in with your massive diesel-engined minivan.
Yeah.
Again,
he never stood Herc. A chance. Herc never stood a chance
no,
against Marlowe.
Not at all. So that's where we are anyway. There's quite a bit that happens in this episode, particularly in the schools. Where do you want to start, Dave?
Let's start with Prez in his class. He's got some maths problems. There was get a nice little scene here where he gives them sort of four options to, you know, it's a classic sort of
multiple choice
apples yep. thing. And one of the little kids is just like, the answer's B. Well, how did you work that out? And he explains that he was just, you know, it's the one that you were tapping previously from previous classes, which I love this. Like,
definitely.
It's so funny, but it also just shows you that
these kids are wise and clever and street smart as well. Like even the ones that who are maybe lacking in the sort of common educational intelligence have.
They know how to get around things.
Smarts, yeah.
Because there's like stories of you know, people who can't read. Quite often, you'll never know. They're very, very good at hiding it, because they've got the wily ways of, you know, avoiding reading in front of people. So you would just assume that people can read.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of thing where they just know how to play the game, they know how to play the system. So in this case, he identifies the correct answer by the dinks, but not by doing it properly. And that just, you know, it just sets them up. It just shows the kind of mindset they have. They can get to an answer, maybe not by the right way, but it gets an answer.
Yeah, everyone expresses intelligence in kind of different ways. Even with Sherrod, as you said, you know, he can't read, but he shows, as Bubbles discovered, this like artistic side to him.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which is like, you know, he was creative and expressing creativity in just in a different form.
Oh, Rashad has 82 apples and 12 friends, all of whom are hungry. And so he looks carefully at his apples and he sees that 7 have worms and another 15 have gone rotten. But he wants to be fair and distribute all the good apples equally.
Distribute?
Give out.
Well, just say that, yo.
Okay, so how many apples does each of Rashad's friends get? A, 4, B, 5, C, 6, or D, 7? Take your time, but do it fast.
Hey, nigga said, I got my rights. So a boy said, oh yeah, well here's a left to go to right. He was like,
pow. Calvin, you done already?
Uh-huh.
Yeah?
B, 5.
How'd you work that out so fast?
Easy. B5 got the dinks.
What?
If you want, I can show you. You did this with the early math class, right? So you like got 82 apples, 12 niggas, and then how many blah blah blah. Then you went like dinking all around this one and no other one. So the answer is B5. Everybody get that?
Yeah.
B5, it got all the dinks. B5, and I'm an Audi 5000.
We also, staying with Prez, we see in this episode he gets, you know, quite frustrated by the sort of the curriculum and the test and, you know, having to be very prescriptive with the way he's teaching, and it kind of doesn't suit him and he's railing against that, which is interesting because he's not somebody like Bunny who traditionally is like trying to test systems. Prez always struck me as a character who fit well into logic and puzzles and like systems and games, and he kind of just always kind of did what he was told.
But Prez is like connecting with the kids, and that's what, you know, that's why he went to the effort of teaching them how to play dice, because he knew it was like, I can teach them but also help connect with them on their level. So the fact that he's
experimenting as well, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's finding
his pathway.
Like we've watched him over these episodes try one way and fail,
yeah,
and then, you know, he's trying a different way and succeeding. So now he's getting frustrated that he can't do what he wants to do,
yeah,
or what he sees working. Speaking of trying to do things different ways, though, let's check in with Bunny and the doctor and the whole psychological experiment.
Mm.
So the kind of Bunny has a bit of a breakthrough here, and we see their new teacher come in, who's a sociologist and a psychologist, I believe. And she's quite impressive.
So is she an external person? Wasn't that clear? But assuming so.
I think so. I think, well, Bunny kind of asks the, you know, the doctor, professor, whatever he is, who she is, and he sort of offhandedly says, you know, she's an expert.
Because she seems to,
psychologist.
Because she seems to get a handle of those guys in the classroom.
Yeah,
quite
really
easily.
Quickly.
Yeah, in a way that Prez couldn't. So she does command their respect and authority.
Yeah, and asks them some really interesting questions. Mm. I thought so, and really heartbreaking stuff. You know, she asks them what their view of themselves is, and what their hopes and dreams are, and you get the little kid Albert says he wants to be a kingpin, and she says, "Oh yeah, what's your timeline for that?" Like 2 years is what he says, and then she says, "Let's think a bit further out. Like let's think, you know, 10 years. How many? What do you think? Where do you think you're going to be in 10 years?" And she says, "How many?" And she's really good. She's like, "How many of you said NBA players?" You know, she kind of like plays around with a bit. And then it's like, "How many of you said dead?" And then you get hands up, including Naaman.
Including Naaman, yeah.
Yeah.
And Naaman, I don't know if he... Again, this is him, we talked about in the last episode, him kind of like acting out in the way that's not really Naaman. He's just feeling that he's almost having to push the limits, push the boundaries a bit here and see what's going on.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's doing it just for laughs, but I don't really feel that he believes what he's saying in the comments. I don't know.
No. I get the sense of Naaman's on a path that has been set for him by his mother and his dad and the world, the only world he knows, but he's not suited to that. And I think even he kind of knows that deep down. Well, but he can't... I think he... Excuse me. I think he genuinely does think that he's likely will be dead in 10 years.
Okay.
I think he does, because I think he understands the danger of this world he's entering, and it's kind of just like it's also indicative of they can't imagine a future for themselves. They literally can't see them even being alive, right? There's no future for them.
Oh, that's dark. That's horrible.
It is dark, but there's optimism in this scene as well, because then little Albert, who said he wanted to be a kingpin 5 minutes ago, says, "Well, actually, in 10 years, I want to be a pediatric neurosurgeon, like Ben Carson." And he has this little connective moment with the doctor who hands him the name Ben Carson.
Mm.
And for me, this was like really optimistic. This moment of like, well, hang on, none of them are even a minute ago he wasn't able to imagine 10 years from now he was just thinking, "I'm going to be a kingpin, that's his path," right? And he's you know, he's Naaman's little lieutenant and all this, and suddenly when he was presented with something a bit more longer term and a bit more optimistic, he was able to come up with an inspirational figure, you know, a black neurosurgeon.
I mean, he had the inspirational figure, but then instantly that opportunity was dashed, because he then had to get grades, which he wasn't going to do to go to medical school, which he wasn't going to do in his current situation.
I know. He was brought back down to earth pretty quick.
Yeah, it was. It was in a massive heap.
Oh, man, I've seen that all the time. I was sometimes put into that special class as a kid.
This is, of course, the one and only Naaman, played brilliantly by Julito McCollum.
You can tell that Naaman lashing out was from a deeper place than other kids, right? There's some kids who eventually they'll chill out, right? Because they realize, okay, I'm not getting anything out of being the bad kid, so let me just focus up and do some work. But Naaman would never, he went entire, man. Naaman had an immense kind of deep hurt inside of him. And I think Bunny saw that early on and to choose him to be in that class, I think was imperative when Naaman's surviving, man. I don't think if Naaman got into that classroom and realized that it was deep, I don't think Naaman would have survived the streets, man. I think what he got out of being in that smaller class with Bunny was a sense of like, I don't need to show out anymore. I don't need to be this facade of myself. I think Naaman needed the Bunny in his life in that moment. And I think what he got out of it was like, I can change, because this is not me. And I think Bunny was just perfect at seeing that in Naaman and helping him, you know, move on from it.
I mean, with Naaman, we go back to him kind of at home, TV on in his bedroom. I don't imagine Bodie and those guys are, you know, making up the package and the vials themselves, are they? with at the parents' houses.
It's really low rent, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
And, but you know, when you're starting out in a business, you do everything. You do the accounts, you pay the wages, you do the stock taking. And when his mum comes and says, no, you need to get a lieutenant to do this, I was kind of like, I kind of get it, but also he needs to do everything in the moment. He needs to learn the system properly.
Yeah. You don't touch the package, man.
No, you don't touch the package.
Get the lieutenants to touch your package. Come on, Kobe.
Sorry.
Have you learned nothing from The Wire?
I haven't researched how
to... You've been paying attention.
How to play with packages.
Each neighborhood around the world, even in the UK, it's always a mom that's willing to pass that baton on that they're... to their child that their dad had.
You're listening to Anwan Glover, who played Slim Charles.
That his dad was portraying this gangster drug dealer, and she wanted her dad, wanted her child to, you know, be the man of the house and go out there and make a living to make sure the household is tight. And that's everywhere. We're just not able to see that showcased. But I think in every neighborhood in America, even in the UK, Africa, it's always a mom to say, hey, you got to be the man in the house. Your dad's gone. He's not coming back. He's dead. He's incarcerated. You got to go out here and sell his dope, and we got to make a living. It's sad, but it's true. And I think the writers were brilliant at that point because they showed that side. And that's Baltimore, Charm City. It's called Charm City, but there's nothing charming about Baltimore but down where the pretty part at. When you go in sad Baltimore, you gotta be on your toes because it will happen. But there's some very super nice people, some super smart people in Baltimore. But I thought that was a brilliant writing to showcase Naaman's mom. She was tough.
I really like, though, we also get a glimpse of Naaman's insightfulness later. Bunny has this breakthrough with the class, and they're reaching them on their levels. They're talking about, like, what it takes to be a corner boy. We've seen all this. That they're starting to open up. And then suddenly there's a scene later where we cut to, an excited Naaman who's, like, talking about, you know, the hypocrisy of the world and tobacco and alcohol are more dangerous and what's the difference, and like he's expressing quite interesting and rational viewpoints about society, like the stuff that kind of The Wire itself is dealing with. So he's got like a brain on him.
Yeah, Naaman's not stupid, and that's probably the one of the most depressing things about it. We know he's not stupid.
Yeah. Yet his bravado and his ego
His life circumstances. Yeah, definitely.
Dan DeLuca, who played my partner in the schools.
This is the man that brought Bunny Colvin to life. It's Robert Wisdom.
That was a great ride for us because we did a lot of the research and stuff together, you know, going to University of Maryland and talking to professors up there about the school system. So we got kind of that big brush thing. And then we just went in, and after we met the kids, and it just got particularized.
Any scene that I had with Bunny was always really good. Such a great actor, dude. He's really, he's a kind actor. Like where he wants you to get your stuff off, and he'll just sit back. And I love that about all the older characters on the show, man. They cared about the kids so much, and they wanted to see us win and do justice to the role. And they, anytime we got to do scenes with them, they always were so generous with like making sure that we got our stuff off, man. Cause we were nervous, you know, going into this show with these big, at this time they're all big actors, you know, and here come these kids. And it was nerve wracking a little bit.
So Michael gets home and discovers that his mom has literally sold the food out of their mouths, as he says it.
Yeah, for drug money. And it's interesting because Michael here at this point is the man of the house, and he's the one that controls the money.
Yeah,
which is like, okay, good. And that's how he kind of commands the house at the moment, because he's the one that textbooks to school, comes back, helps him with his homework, makes sure he's clean. And that's his kind of role as protector, and that's great because he holds the money.
Because his mother is not capable of it.
Not capable of doing it. If she's selling the food, which is literally the saddest, because I was it's quite depressing that the Dookie's people are selling school clothes for drugs money.
Yeah.
But if they're selling food for drug money, then it's, it just shows what kind of dire situation people are in. But then later in the episode, Bug's father comes back, and then he's now the man in the house, but Michael's not happy about it because it seems there's
he flinches when
he's been touched.
The man goes to touch him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, this, I think this will unfold. We're not going to talk about so much here because it kind of unfolds in future episodes. But this is the first time Bug's father comes back into the episode, into the season.
And I think they express a lot through Michael's reactions here and his panic when he goes to pick up Bug at the later part of the episode and he's not there.
Mm.
He's living in fear of this man.
Yeah.
And it's, we're getting, you know, we're even a first time viewer can read between the lines here, I think.
Right. As you all know, we do have a Patreon page at patreon.com/thewirestripped. But we now have another way you can help us out and the Ella Thompson Fund.
Yeah. So if you guys are listening on Apple Podcasts, you can subscribe to us to get a lot of the same benefits as a Patreon account, but it makes it easier if you want to help contribute to the lovely people at Ella Thompson Fund, who, just to remind you, I'm sure we've said a few times this episode already, but they help support underprivileged kids in Baltimore in the way that Cutty did in The Wire.
So you can get access to our episodes early. You can get access to our full interviews with the cast and crew, including our extended interview with David Simon.
No adverts on there as well. And also, Basking in the Glory, they help out a lot of lovely people in Baltimore and the kids there. It's simple. If you're on Apple Podcasts, scroll up the feed now and there's a button for you to click on, and it costs less than the price of a coffee every month to support lots of lovely people.
Politics. We're with Carchetti and he's going round and he's doing his ride-along thing.
He's packing a lot in, isn't he?
Well, good.
He's seeing all the departments.
It's like one of my friends, he got a graduate university after graduating from university, got a job at Sainsbury's. But what these guys have to do at Sainsbury's?
Can't wait till this ties around to The Wire.
Stick with it, kids. Yeah. But yeah, so he got a grad job at Sainsbury's, so he's working in the big shiny offices. But everyone who works there at some point has to work on the shop floor in Sainsbury's to know how it works.
Yeah.
So this is what Carchetti's doing. He's packing the shelves.
Learning the ropes.
He's learning ropes.
He's packing shelves.
But he's learning ropes by seeing how not to do it.
His trip with the Eastern was a bit of a disaster.
For fuck's sake.
Yeah. What's interesting here is that it's clear that Carchetti can see that this is not the way it should be done.
Mm.
But they are so proud of themselves, right?
Like, that's one.
Yeah. Oh, God, it's the worst. That's two, Mr. Mayor. These guys are going around like they're in CSI Miami. Mm. Like they're in a cop show. You know, they're in The Shield. They're busting heads. This is like Herc and Carve from last season.
Yeah.
Right at the beginning of last season in the Western, this is literally their counterparts in the Eastern.
But it's so bad that the first guy to stop, he's just cycling along, presumably going to work, stops to buy drugs, and he goes, well, just
you go buy them over there, you get them.
You just get over there.
Yeah. It's like, no, you get them for me. It's like they it was that was, you know, they describe it. Carchetti describes it later as entrapment or or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, like they basically coerced him into doing that.
Which is,
in a way.
Which is gash. It's the worst. And obviously, like I said, Carchetti sees right through it. Not impressed. He's probably dejected at this point. He just thinks, what is the point? And off he goes to Rawls to have a chat about it. And Rawls goes, we have to juke the stats. And because of affirmative action,
Rawls,
guys.
Yeah, I know, and he blames it on affirmative action. The absolute goal. And then, but he does, the basically says, you know, now I'm not racist, but he essentially says that.
Yeah.
Now I'm no racist, I'm no more a racist than you, Mr. Mayor. And you're obviously not a racist. But it's obviously because of affirmative action that this has happened.
Yeah.
And we're having to, it's just like Norman Wilson's face says it all, because this just is he's blaming all of the problems which he has perpetuated on...
Because Burrell's in charge.
On, yeah, exactly.
What's
ridiculous about it is that he's criticizing a stats-driven system in the Comstat. He is Captain Comstat.
Oh, he is.
He loves the stats.
He does. But I think
he loves chewing people out.
This is his opportunity to get the next rung up the ladder.
Yeah, so he's telling Carchetti what he wants to hear.
What he thinks Carchetti wants to hear.
Yeah, well, yes, exactly.
And obviously, I mean, Carchetti's been told that he personally can't fire Burrell, which is kind of understandable. And I don't think he'd even want... Would he even want Rawls in the top position? I think he sees Rawls as... a better version, better at the two, but he's not the best person.
No, his eyes, he wants, his eyes are, he only has eyes for Daniels.
He has, which is great.
Daniels is who he wants.
I have to tell you, I was just devastated. These are the ones for me, as an advocate and a youth advocate and a defense attorney, that just make my stomach just turn, right?
This is Kristen Henning. She's the director of the Georgetown Juvenile Justice Initiative, and she's also the author of Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth.
So that literally, you know, it was two sort of back-to-back, there's almost a bet, right, between two groups of officers, how many arrests can they make? How many collars, I think they call it, can they make, you know, while Carchetti is on the ride-along, right? Carchetti, I'm sorry, is on the ride-along. And the first two that we get, one is of a guy who's on his way to work. He's on a bike on his way to work, and he gets stopped by these undercovers who are like, hey, where do we get some drugs? Where do we get our stuff? And he's like, dude, over there. And they're like, but wait, can't you help us go get them? And they literally send him, and he's like, what? And you can see his face, like, get out yourself and go get your own drugs. But and he literally puts his bike down, he goes and gets the drugs, comes back, gets on his bike, and tries to head on to work. And lo and behold, he gets stopped by officers. So he's the intermediary. He's not even like the, you know, like, we don't even know for sure that on a regular day he would be a drug dealer, right? He just literally gets asked, where do I get drugs? Can you go get me some? So that to me just was insane. They collar him, put him away, and, you know, even, you know, Carchetti, he's even like, really? Like, this is what we're doing for policing? And, you know, and they describe it as bullshit policing, right? Like, what are we doing, right? And they have, you know, there's conversations about later about what constitutes real policing, right? You know, real policing is that high-end police work that really reduces violence, right? But instead, the politicians, the mayors, and the police majors are under extreme pressure to reduce to reduce crime and to get, you know, drugs off the street. And one of the ways they do it is by driving up their numbers, right? Being able to say they had X number of arrests. And so that's where we get into sort of the bullshit policing instead of real policing, which requires cultivating relationships, nuanced investigation, and building your cases and investing resources on that end. So, you know, it's, you know, I tell you, you know, policing has been so politicized in our country for years.
Drug prohibition has excused the collapse of our civil liberties, the destruction of the Fourth Amendment, of our Bill of Rights, of our Constitution. It has taught generations of police how not to police.
This is, of course, the man himself, David Simon.
How to go in people's pockets, how to make stats, how to lock people up. But while they've been doing this and getting better and better at doing that, which is a meaningless act of non-police work, the arrest rates for murder, for rape, for robbery, for burglary, for assault have declined dramatically. Because those things rely on police work and a lot of skill sets that really, truly matter. And if you don't reward those skill sets, if you don't promote them, if you don't promote the police who are capable of them, if you don't pay the police to perform those jobs rather than you pay them to fill the wagons with drug users, then you get a police department, a police agency that can only police the drug war, and they can't actually solve crime or make the city safer. And that's what Baltimore's done. So we are now, I'm now in the most violent Baltimore that's ever existed in terms of the crime rate. And we have a bunch of police who know how to go into people's pockets run up on the corner. They don't need the, they don't need probable cause. They just, you know, you're hey, you're in the corner, you're in my corner, recorder's indicted. Let me see what in your pockets. That's not, you know, you can't take that guy and put him in front of a dead body and say, solve that, you know, address that. You know, he doesn't have the skill set. And that's the police departments that we created over 50 years. I mean, it's been one generation knowing less, teaching the next generation to know even less.
Just to round off the politics, there's an interesting scene where a member of the Democrat Party visits their campaign office to sort of look a bit more long term and look, you know, kind of line Carchetti up for a governor run in 2 years. So they're kind of saying what he needs to do and focus on. And she says, you know, right, well, you got to deliver your campaign promise of cutting crime by 10%, which just ties into all this, you know, that's why his big focus on crime.
Sure. Yeah.
But, you know, just incidentally in this room, it's brought up, you know, what about the schools? And then Norman Wilson, you know, very bluntly says, you know, stay away from, just almost casually, just no, stay, you got to stay away from schools. Because, and then he gives some context about it being like, that was, you know, a mess that Royce made. And then if you go in there and try and unpick that, it's going to become your mess.
Mm.
So basically they're saying, like, they're acknowledging, we've spent this season and a lot of this season with Prez and with these kids and, you know, learning of the issues and hearing it firsthand. Then we're up with the policymakers who are in a position where they can change it. And we I really like Norman Wilson as well, but he's just offhandedly saying, you can't even, just don't even bother, right? Because that's too much of a mess. And then it's going to affect your run for governor in 2 years. And
yeah.
That is why democracy can fail.
That's what the system is just like. You're putting one person's career progression ahead of
fixing a city,
and a future, helping people,
the future of the city.
Yeah, exactly. It's dark. And Norman, why was it you that said that?
But it's almost just the offhandedness of it. There's no callousness there.
Yeah.
Because we know Norman's a good guy. I don't think Norman, in any other rational situation, he would believe that in like the right to, he would want kids to be educated properly, but he's just in this position, in this job where they've all become desensitized to it.
And
he's just looking at, like everyone else, he's looking at stats and polling figures and numbers, and 10% reduction in crime gets you this.
I think it's like, to bring in Succession again, we're going to weave in Succession, guys. It's the NRPI, no real person involved. That's
yes,
what they think of the schools.
That's exactly it. Yeah, yeah. It's just
not, they're not real people.
They're not. They're below the line to them.
We know exactly where we lose our kids, where we create those desperate people of the future who then act out.
This is the one and only Bunk, Wendell Pierce himself.
How people thrive from keeping an underclass, you know, thrive. Our education system was destroyed because people said, let's make it inclusive. And we have, from that moment on in America, said, oh, you want to make it inclusive? We're going to do everything possible to destroy the education system. So you want it? You got it. But now we're going to destroy it from within.
I feel like what The Wire does overall is just points out that, like, that these are all institutions. They're all institutions that have problems.
This is Jennifer Wood. She's the editor of Mental Floss.
And they have problems that need to be fixed. But the way to fix them is then to, like, rope in another institution that has the same failings. So if I'm a school district need more money, you know, to help these kids, like, I need to go to the politicians who are then trying to go here. So it's just like this constant, you know, like everyone's leaning on everyone. And it's I'm just painting the world as a wonderful place right now.
So just to round off Carchetti's tour of Baltimore's police, goes to Homicide, which is great.
He doesn't get as much of a warm welcome here, which I enjoy.
I love it. The guys there don't give a shit.
Yeah, they really don't.
No.
Nobody's really pandering to him. I really enjoyed Kima and the coffee. It was like, you fill that coffee up, motherfucker.
Of course. It's just common decency.
Well, yeah, exactly. But also, she's not afraid to tell him, and she's pissed off because of her she got dragged through the muck with the witness case because of him.
Definitely.
Yeah.
But then we have some comedy scenes. Well, we say people don't care, but at the same time, there's like, oh, this is the mayor. We should at least keep up some appearances.
Yeah, everyone's flicking through files. Yeah. And there's like, don't mind me, do what you normally do.
And it all turns.
So Lester brings out his dollhouse.
Brilliant.
And his little furniture. Kima just puts her feet up and relaxes. And what does Jay do?
Landsman pulls out a porno mag.
Yeah.
Which isn't in his office. So where is
yeah.
Why is he stashing his porno mags all around the office?
Got them all around.
He just needs them at like a moment's notice.
I hadn't even thought about that.
What's he doing?
Just stashed around the whole office. I love that that's his thing though. He reads porn and he's also a beautiful eulogy speech writer, right? Because you get this you get this offhand thing at the top of that scene where he's announces the death of the homicide commander.
Yeah, Forster.
Forster.
Yeah.
And then he says some, you know, he gives a sort of a brief eulogy, but it's before they even get to the bar, and it's just like he's got such a beautiful way with words. Well, Landsman.
So yeah, in the previous season, Delaney Williams, the actor who plays Jay Landsman, wasn't actually due to be around that much. When Robert Causbury actually died, who played Coles in the season, I think Delaney Williams was working in the theatre, but he wanted to come back to be the one that delivered the eulogy. And you can see why. Like I say, Landsman's such an interesting character because he's, as you say, he's kind of the perfect middle manager. He's happy being there.
Yeah.
But then he's got some
relatively effective.
Yeah. He's got some fantastic attributes and that's one of them.
But also reads porn magazines. Yeah, hides porn magazines around the office.
Stashes porn magazines around the office. I'm sure like a squirrel, like a porn squirrel.
Yeah. Porn squirrel.
Hello, Kobe and Dave. This is Juan Carlos Ortecho from Lima, Peru. I'm JC Ortecho on Twitter. Just wanted to thank you guys. Leave this message on the burner phone for the wonderful work you've done with The Wire Stripped. Massive fan of the show since I lived in the States many years ago. And you've been a great company on my evening walks here by the South Pacific. You can probably hear it in the background with my dog Canelo. And season 4 is hands down my favorite. Best season, best show ever. Thank you. And goodbye.
Thank you very much for that burner message. If you want to leave your own burner message, you can do it by sending us a voice memo to this number. Take it away, Prez.
+44 75 348 3 1 6 5 8 Our number.
So if you didn't catch that, that's +44 75 348 3 1 6 5 8 That number's also on our social channels at The Wire Stripped. Or if you don't like sending messages to phone numbers, send it via an email. burner@thewirestripped.com
Yeah, thank you very much to a frequent contributor, Joe Kiley, for getting Prez in an interview booth to record that number.
Love for us. That.
If you do, whilst we have you here, guys, if you do want to get any more content from us, please go to www.patreon.com/thewirestripped and you can get more content. You can get episodes in advance, you can get exclusive episodes, you can get stickers, all by joining us at patreon.com. And any money that you give us there goes 100% to the Ella Thompson Fund, which is a charity in Baltimore that is set up to help underprivileged kids. Think Cutties, Jim, and that's exactly who you're supporting in this by contributing to our Patreon.
All right, we're in Homicide, so let's check in with Bunk and the Omar case. So he's hot on the trail. He's reopened this cold case.
Crutchfield and Holly are not happy. But at least he convinces Holly. Me, Crutchfield, I don't think we've seen much of him before this, but
no.
comes across as...
He's a crutchety old guy.
Yeah, exactly. Crutchety Crutchfield. But Holly, you know, he comes along and says, I'll indulge your bunk. I'll indulge your foibles.
He seems quite easily swayed, yeah. All right.
I do like Holly, apart from when he beats up Bubbles.
Let's not talk about that. So they go back over the scene. Bunk, like a badass, just walks in like Kima in the last episode, just completely cracks the whole case open just in one fell swoop. Walks in, asks old Andre a couple of questions. What about this? And it's like, and then goes outside and schools Holly on the whole thing.
Yeah, broke it down in three, didn't he?
Yeah.
That's really cool. And I love it when you see good police work, like we saw in the last episode with Kima, like we saw the fuck scene, like we saw with Lester. It's always nice when you see, like...
It's satisfying, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. It's like neat when you watch that Sherlock kind of process.
Do you think
deduction process.
Do you think Bunk has a memory palace like Sherlock?
I think so, yeah. I think he was running, he was seeing equations pop up in front of his eyes.
For my friend here, tell me one more time how the thing went down, will you?
The boy came in.
Omar.
He puts a 9 on her, says to me, whatever you got.
Mm-hmm. A 9, huh? Where were you?
Where you see me at?
Mm-hmm.
And then they play a whole game with, you know, he's just such a good detective, such good police. We see him playing a game with Andre in the jury summons and the grand jury summons, and it's all, there's a lot of theater with Bunk as well. It's like,
yeah,
well, how much
10
are you
going
to get? 10 years? Yeah. Andre swallows it anyway and gets spooked, and suddenly his memory gets a bit hazy. Oh, could have been anybody. Actually, now that you mention it.
Nah, I wouldn't go through this. Why'd you come out?
Because you said to.
Trying to save her life.
Right. I'm saying.
This is like Bank of England glass. Fort Knox glass. And who put that up there? Guy must have had an elephant gun. Some shit.
I don't know. The boy had a mask on.
A mask, huh? Like Zorro, huh? When did that happen?
Few weeks back.
Put in a report?
It got away from me.
Mm-hmm. Andre, we gonna need you to come down to the office, straighten out a couple of things.
And then we get back to Jay. Comes back to Jay, and he's got a black turned to red again.
Yeah.
He's not happy.
That's the worst thing you can do to Jay. Apart from hide his pornos. he'll sniff them out anyway. Just a little bit I want to talk about, and I might just spoil a bit in season 5 for this, because it's probably something I'll forget to talk about later on in season 5. Minor spoilers for season 5. So the person, we see someone come into the shop to see old face Andre, and it's this character called Dee Dee. And you see her, you glimpse her in, I think it's the previous season, she's buying drugs out of a car.
Yeah.
In this season, the bit of discourse you have with she has with Andre makes out that she's a prostitute. And then you see her like in the scene in season 5 where she's in Narcotics Anonymous talking about how she's gone to recovery.
Oh yeah.
And this is quite often picked out as like a really key, interesting character in the why you see like 3 times at 3 different stages in her life, and this is the second time you see her. And then if I remember in season 5, I'll bring it up again. But just harking back to this point, this is the second time you see this one person, Dee Dee.
Yeah, that's nice. You get
take
a little, subplot going on.
No more spoilers for season 5. I love it when we hang out with Chris and Snoop. These guys are fierce and fucking scary. And this comes off the back of Prop Joe almost saying, guys, you're killing the guys, which is good, but you're doing too good a job.
You're not scared. You need to send a message to these New York guys.
So let's kill them.
Your whole thing. And I love how delicately he does this.
Yeah.
with Slim Charles. And they're just like, no, guys, we're massive fans of the way you're just shadowing people and making them disappear. Don't get us wrong, but you need to send a message to New York, or they'll just think that they've just gone back to Brooklyn or whatever.
Exactly.
And what I like about Marlowe is that, like, he's kind of, he's getting a lot from this Prop Joe relationship.
Definitely.
And he's, but he's listening. He's ears open, and he's like, he knows when to take good advice. He's not massively a proud person. I think he's willing to accept advice. And he does. So the solution is for Chris and Snoop to start openly killing people in the most public way possible. In a very darkly comic way that they go about it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's comic because the way they're trying to determine who's from New York and who's from Baltimore is by what music they like.
Yeah.
But dark because when they find someone who doesn't know the music, they just shoot them in the face and walk off, and they don't even... Do not give a flying fuck.
So scary.
Let's do it.
I'm just gonna walk up on him, all right? Snap one. We gotta make sure you're from New York first, right? Gotta ask.
Ask what? You from New York?
Nah, ask a Baltimore question. Some of the New York nigga won't know.
What's a Baltimore question, yo?
I don't know, like, maybe something about club music. They don't know nothing about that shit up in New York.
Huh?
Asking, like, who Young Leak be.
I like to watch this scene with Snoop and Chris walking up to people, asking them, and what he said, who Young Leak be? Chris would know who all of the people on the radio is, because he drives around all day.
This is the voice of Nathan Corbett, who played Donut.
Right? And so when you think about it, it's like, damn, that shit makes sense. Like, and it almost reminds me of the No Country for Old Men, right? When he walks into the shop and he tells the guy to flip the coin. And this guy has no idea that one slight motion of anything is going to get this man killed. So when they ask him the right question and Snoop is about to smoke the man, you know, it's like, man, this brother had no idea what he was in for. I love that scene. I love all Snoop and Chris scenes.
Man, I don't know nothing about that 92 cube shit, man. Man, who gives a fuck, yo?
You don't know Mark Clark. The Big Fat Morning Show. You ain't right, girl. The average Baltimore nigga know all that shit, all right? They don't listen to that shit up in New York.
A lot of the actors was already from New York, which is why they made it like that, right? And then the texture and the climax of that time in New York City, and the texture and the climax at the time in Baltimore, Maryland, there was a little war. There's like a little beef. If you was from New York and you were from Baltimore, y'all came across each other. People were fighting or arguing or debating, whatever the fuck he was doing, but it was a real beast going on. You know, so the way you wear your clothes, the music, we was just different, the fashion, like the women, it was different. You know what I'm saying? So again, The Wire was really a show that didn't hide anything that was authentic to the culture.
Shaking and jiggle it, yo. Who made that track? Yo, who you talking to, dog? I'm asking who Young Leak be.
You mean Too Fast Cousin?
Who?
Nah.
Nigga, how the fuck should I know?
Yo, who the fuck is you talking?
Oh, shit. Fuck on you.
And Baltimore pick you out a lineup quick. They know if you're not from Baltimore. If you from New York, did they know you, man? You ain't from around here. What you doing, Dick? What you doing, Dad? And of course, that is, they know. But you just got to be on point. And then, like, you know, it comes with it. New York cats, they think they can go anywhere and set up shop. They'll sell rocks to their grandma. They go anywhere and set up shop and just be like, hey, we going to go. And that's one thing I take my hat off to New Yorkers. Opportunity opens, they going to go. And that was another piece of good writing, because New York came down to Baltimore. Also, New York went to D.C. and hustle and shut up shop. A lot of them was killed and a lot of them wasn't. A lot of them survived and a lot of them didn't. Yeah, but that was real. That was 100% real.
It's such good writing, this little scene between Chris and Snoop. So hats off to Richard Price, who wrote this episode. The interactions that they have when they're trying to concoct this plan, little back and forth, where Chris is like reeling off all these local Baltimore stations, and Snoop's like, "What are you talking about, man?" And he's like, "How do you even from Baltimore? You don't know X, Y, Z." While also just like proving the point of the pointlessness of the system. She's from Baltimore and she doesn't know what you're talking about.
And I love it when she accosts the first guy and gets it completely wrong. She's literally about to pull the trigger.
No, Chris wait! Like, no, wait. That guy was also on that show.
Yeah.
Got a bet going on, man.
So,
who's your favorite one on the Big Fat Morning Show, yo?
Rookie New York girl.
Who?
So is he.
Who?
Get with that show any day.
Snoop, yo. Chill, yo. Sanjay be on the show, too.
Close that man came to dying. For
fucking
nothing.
Hell, yeah.
So maybe I ask the questions from now on, right?
It's so it's so dark.
It is dark. It's funny and scary and dark, and it is superbly written.
And then we get again, Prop Joe being just awesome and so gutted we never have the opportunity to speak to Robert Chu. But Prop Joe takes the card that Marlo got from Herc.
And he brings the card to the payphone and starts this is one of my favorite scenes in all of The Wire. Prop Joe's whole like theater of the mind, all these voices.
Brilliant.
Oh my god, the tour. But he could have just what I love about this scene is that Joe could have just stuck with the one voice of these calls.
Exactly.
And he's challenging himself to mix it up. Like he's talking to different people every time. It could have just been the same pretend doctor, but it's like, no, now I'm a neurosurgeon from
the name changes each time as well.
Yes, like it's absolute genius. It just shows you the creativity of this man that like, you know, we've seen him be wise and calm and reassuring. But like we've never seen him be like playful and like I love how confidently he switches between characters as well. It's so delightful.
But what we do find, what we do see a little piece which does play into later episodes, guys, so listen out, is Herc does stop Chris and Snoop. And they've got a little cheeky gun compartment which is in a different area to the glove box.
Yeah, it's clever, isn't it?
And they put the gun in there. Hides away, and they search the car. Don't find anything, but they find a nail gun.
Yeah,
and obviously Herc pissed off. He's like, it fires a nail gun into the pavement, into the road, and then leaves them to go off. And they're so close to being caught, with a gun. I'm not sure what Herc knew. I don't think Herc knew what he was looking for, really.
Herc's just looking to intimidate them.
Yeah.
This is Herc looking for his camera, right?
Yeah.
So he's just going to be up in all your faces. He's hassling Marlo. He's hassling all of Marlo's people until he gets his camera back.
Well, let's go back to the camera then, because the reason he's scared about the camera is because Mario Moto is on his case. And Herc didn't get the camera legitimately. He just took it without asking.
And Marimo's had a complaint about Herc from the woman he accosted at the airport.
From the skinny lady.
At the train station.
Yeah.
And he asked who his CI is. So obviously Herc had put down like a CI rather than the surveillance camera, which he's got. He's like, he's tied himself up in knots.
For no reason.
Just to try and get Marlo. Just do it legitimately. Like you were there for season one of The Wire, man. You saw how it's done.
It might take a bit longer.
But that's exactly why he hasn't done it. He wants quick solutions to everything. That's why he's screaming at Randy for, tell me you were there.
Yeah.
He wants the solution right now.
Straight away.
Right.
But it brings back Fuzzy Dunlop, which is like, when he said it, I was like, yay, Fuzzy Dunlop.
One of our favourite characters.
It's like, where's this going to go for you, Fuzzy Dunlop? What are you doing, mate? Herc, I love you, but at the same time, stop it.
Right, that's it from us this week. So next week, we're going to be chatting about episode 9 of season 4. It's called Know Your Place. As always, we would like to thank Martin and Sam from the Song by Song podcast, who wrote this awesome cover of Way Down in the Hole, which you're hearing right now.
Yeah, thank you very much to Black Snow Comics on Instagram, that's aka Michael Balistrieri, who made the images for season 4 of The Four Boys of Summer, for example. Guys, you can see it right now, and it's great. Thank you very much, Michael.
A big shout out to our overlord, exec producer, and editor, T-Bone Tom Wally.
Yeah, and also the guy that keeps everything going on this careering train. It's Obi Joshua, our producer. Thank you so much.
If it wasn't for Obi, these series would be released every 4 years instead of every 1 to 2 years.
Like an Olympic cycle, you mean?
Yes.
Every time there's an Olympics.
Lastly, all of our transcribing is done with the help of Sonix, S-O-N-I-X. And you can get 100 free minutes of transcriptions. If you need transcriptions, then do it at sonix.ai/invite/stripped.
All right, guys. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening.
See you next time.
Bye.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.